Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the terrorist bombings in Brussels, Belgium, that Daesh, the self-declared Islamic State, have taken credit for, and speak with Philippe Malière, the Marcel Liebman Chair of Political Science at the Université Libre de Bruxelles, the Free University of Brussels. He joins us to discuss the lack of coordination between the 6 local and 1 federal police forces in Brussels alone, and the slow reaction of the Belgian authorities to the growth of radical Islam that has resulted in Belgium providing the largest number of jihadis per capita who have fought for Daesh in Syria and Iraq. Then we'll look into how Republican presidential candidates Donald Trump and Ted Cruz might exploit the terrorist attacks, given that Ted Cruz has already weighed in, stating that on the home front, quote, we need to empower law enforcement to patrol and secure Muslim neighborhoods before they become radicalized. Lawrence Korb, who served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction, joins us to discuss alternative security strategies to stoking Islamophobia and xenophobia. Then finally, we'll examine the voter turnout myths, claims, and facts so far in this election and compare the history of primary voters and voting turnout in the general election to determine whether there is an enthusiasm gap between the Republicans and the Democrats brought on by Donald Trump's claim of being a magnet for new voters. Michael McDonald, a professor of political science at the University of Florida and the director of the United States Election Project, joins us to provide the real numbers as to whether Donald Trump is getting out more people to vote for him or motivating more people to vote against him. And joining us now is Philippe Malière, who is a professor of French and European politics at University College in London, who in 2007 was awarded the Marcel Liebman Chair in Political Science by the Université Libre de Bruxelles, the Free University of Brussels. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philippe Malière.
Hello.
And obviously there's been a terrible tragedy in Brussels, very close in terms of proximity. The railway car that was blown up was within a couple of blocks of the. It's in the district called the EU district, in an area where the EU buildings are. And just only a few days ago on Friday, the leaders of the European Union met to discuss the refugee crisis. So it's really striking at the heart of Europe, if you will. But, Philippe, this is not entirely without precedent in terms of Brussels being a focus of terrorism. Belgium is believed to be the source of the weapons used in the January 2015 Charlie Hebdo attacks. Before that, there was a mass shooting in May of 2014 when a terrorist opened fire on a Jewish museum in Brussels. And almost all of the planning for the attacks on Paris on the November the 13th were carried out in Belgium, in Brussels itself, in Molenbeek, along with those who participated in it. Apparently all came from that area or that suburb, commune, I guess it's called. And on top of that, about 560 Belgian citizens have gone to Syria and Iraq to fight with ISIS. So what's going on?
Well, that's correct. Belgium and Brussels, notably, have been both a magnet and a target for Islamic terrorists in Europe. I think, there are objective reasons to that. It seems to be a bit of a soft spot, if you like. Intelligence in Belgium is, although it hosts the EU institutions, so for that reason you can imagine there are police forces and intelligence, but apparently one of the problems with Islamic terrorism in Brussels is that intelligence really doesn't work very well, and there are different layers, if you like. As you know, Belgium is a federal country, and so there is the local level, Belgium city, the Brussels city, then the level of the region, and then you've got, of course, the separation between the French-speaking part and the Flemish-speaking part. And all that doesn't seem to be working very well. Of course, Belgium is also a small country, doesn't have the resources in terms of intelligence and counter-terrorist forces that, for instance, France and Britain, which have been, you know, also targeted for a long time have. So that's why it is pretty easy. It's also very easy. All the weapons, you know, TNT, Kalashnikovs, bombs, pistols. Apparently, it's a whole market there. This is where terrorists, French ones notably, go and buy them. And apparently, it's easy to find them. It's easy to bring them from Brussels. And that's why, you know, for instance, the killers in Paris, both Charlie Hebdo in January 2015 and again in November 2015, I think, they had spent time in Brussels. They had bought their weapons there. So, yes, it's been a problem. And I think on top of that, like in France, there is a very important Muslim community, of course, which in its large majority oppose and reject those terrorist actions and crimes. However, in the case of one of the perpetrators of the November attacks in Paris, Salah Abdeslam, he managed, and he's a Frenchman, he managed to hide and to stay in hiding in one of the areas of Brussels, Molenbeek, which hosts a very strong concentration of Muslims. So he managed to hide there for many months, although he was the police was looking for him. So it's really, yes, I think we with discussions in Europe, in France, in the UK, and other countries, and Belgium, of course, are sort of looking at Belgium now as a bit of a soft spot, you know, a place where it is too easy to get weapons, too easy to hide, and clearly the Belgian police, I think, will be told to probably do things a little bit better.
Well, Mr. Abdeslam, Salah Abdeslam, who was captured quite recently in Molenbeek, he and his brother, Ibrahim, was one of the attackers in Paris on November the 13th. He blew himself up at a Paris cafe. Prior to that, the two of them ran a bar in Molenbeek where basically young men traded drugs and drank tea and watched ISIS videos of fighting in Syria. And, of course, Abdeslam, as far as we know, might well be connected to these two attacks in Belgium, one at the airport and one at a railway station within blocks of the EU Commission headquarters, because there's a speculation amongst anti-terrorism specialists that they were worried, the rest of his cell were worried that he was going to be talking to the police, because he was already considered the reluctant jihadi who didn't blow himself up at the football stadium in Paris and is supposedly squealing to the authorities. So the theory is that they had to move up this attack because they thought they might be rounded up based on evidence that Salah Abdeslam might well be giving the police. Is that your understanding?
Yes, possibly. I think the police haven't established those, first of all, the links between Salah Abdeslam and the perpetrators of the attacks today in Brussels. But it could very well be, indeed, that there is a link, and the fact that Abdeslam was arrested last week, and probably fearing that he would start speaking to the police, they probably acted probably sooner than probably they had planned to do. But I think there's also, if you look at the situation, you know, sort of, it is very clear that the Belgian police, which had been, you know, for a while under criticism, came under criticism from French and British police, notably, had been putting pressure very much on, notably, this Molenbeek quarter of Brussels, saying, well, basically, the other polices in Europe arguing that the Belgian police wasn't doing enough. So it could be paradoxically that this attack was provoked by more intense pressure put by the police on people hiding in those places. It doesn't mean that those attacks were planned today, but probably they acted upon a situation which probably wasn't. They were risking probably of being arrested. So that could be one possibility. But we shall see what the police will establish in this respect. It seems that When you look, you gave the figure of 560 Muslims in Belgium, most of them being of Belgian nationality. The overall Muslim population in Belgium, you know, Belgium is a small country of 11,000 people. There's about 500,000 Muslims there. So 560 went to Syria to fight, for instance. That's quite an impressive figure. It's also very interesting to note that the people went there had no particular background, you know, in terms of religious background, or were not seen or were not known as people who had been, you know, radicalized. So it's the same story as in Paris when they attacked, you know, the attackers were people were not known or not very well known sometimes by the police because their radicalization was pretty recent. You know, they no religious background then started, you know, sort of being socialized to Islam, but of course of a very fundamentalist type by some people, and then the jump, you know, the big thing is really to the Syria trip. You know, they go to Syria, they fight, they come back, and when they come back, they are ready to perpetrate those attacks. And it is really something which starts from our shores in Europe, you know, in Brussels, in France, in the UK, all the perpetrators, you know, they haven't been people coming from Syria. They've been people who were born in France, in Belgium, or the UK.
Again, I'm speaking with Philippe Mallier, who's a professor of French and European politics at University College in London, who in 2007 was awarded the Marcel Liebman Chair in Political Science by the Université Libre de Bruxelles, the Free University of Brussels. But in terms of the fellow that was just captured, the last person involved in the Paris attacks, Salah Abdeslam, the break in that case came in a raid on an apartment about 6 miles from Molenbeek, and that was just last week, and the police were met with gunfire. They killed Mohamed Belkaid, who's a 35-year-old Algerian who'd been linked previously to the Paris plot. But two men escaped from that, and that's, I think, probably why there's a suspicion that these cases today, the bombings today, may be linked. And indeed, these two men may well be the perpetrators, because they did find in this apartment large quantities of ammunition, the ISIS flag, and, of course, key to the investigation, Salah Abdeslam's fingerprints. They found detonators as well. So I think there's a reasonable assumption that there could well be a linkage.
Yes, indeed, yes.
So let's then turn to the history of why it is that you have, I believe, the number of jihadists coming from Belgium to fight in Syria and Iraq is the highest per capita of any European country.
That's correct, yes.
But the history, surely, of radicalization goes back to this group called Sharia for Belgium, four being with the number four, which was led by Fouad Belhassem. And it started out in Antwerp, and it first gained notoriety because they staged these public commemorations of the 9/11 attacks, which is pretty provocative in itself, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. This was really a turning point when you had, for the very first time, you know, in the early years of the 21st century, you know, you had the first terrorist groups, you know, getting organized there. But I should say that, in fact, there's an even longer history of terrorism in Belgium, and with very strong ties to France. And I think that started as early as the 1980s and 1990s, where you then had, notably in the 1990s, of course, the first wave of terrorist attacks on French soil, then, following, you know, the Muslims being on the verge of seizing power, and then a coup by the military to stop it. So you had, of course, a number of attacks which were perpetrated on French soil. And when the French police, you know, really started to go very strongly on those terrorists, you know, on French soil, some of them chose, they were either expelled, but some of them chose to go to cross the border and to go to Belgium, where, you know, it would be easier for them to retreat at least for a while and get organized. So I think it is really the sort of the history, the background to sort of terrorism in Belgium comes from there, start from France, and then move to Belgium in the 1990s. I think, again, the history of terrorism in Belgium can't be separated, you know, from what's been happening in France, from the wider geopolitical situation involving France as a sort of medium-sized power in the world, with military intervention in the Middle East, in Africa, in several parts of the world. And also, the other reason is, of course, France has the biggest Muslim population in Europe. So for all those reasons, terrorists have always been keen on targeting France first. And that's why all the movements coming from all the things you have in Brussels now, they can't be associated. There is a tie, there is a link with what is happening in France, or what happened in the past in France.
Well, but it's pretty extraordinary, isn't it, to think that this group, Sharia for Belgium, which we mentioned earlier, gained attention by staging these public commemorations of the 9/11 attacks, first in Antwerp and then across Belgium. It was only last February when 45 of members, including the leader of this group, Fouad Bellesem, were convicted for recruiting young people in Brussels and Antwerp to fight in Syria. So, I mean, they've been operating for a long time, haven't they?
That's why, and that's the reason why the British police came under quite fierce criticism, you know, on part from their French and British colleagues, German colleagues as well, saying, well, they were a bit of a soft touch. It was far too easy. They gave too much room for maneuver, so to speak. They were even publicly able to organize a number of public events and were also able in some quarters, notably of Brussels, to notably around Mursk, but also, as you noted earlier, you know, Salah Abdel Salam was running a business in Brussels. He was known. But, of course, it lasted quite a long time. And I think it is very likely now that the Belgian forces are going probably to change tactic on that and probably do what the British, following their French counterparts in the 1990s, did, which was also, I remember, discussions on counterterrorism in the 1990s in France, and French police complaining about Britain being a bit of a soft touch, being too understanding about the rise of, at the time, you know, 1990s, 20 years ago, the rise of Islamic terrorism. And of course, then in Britain, you had the turning point in 2005, you know, the bombing in the terrorist attack in the London Tube, followed by also in a London bus. And the mood and the police also completely changed. They changed the tactic, they changed the way. And I think Britain has become a place where it is much harder. And intelligence has also developed, got more professional. And since 2005, of course, any attack could happen anytime, anywhere in Europe and in the world, as we know. No intelligence, no police, even the best, could possibly stop everything. But so far, since 2005, there hasn't been any further attacks. So there's been a change, really. The French police, as we know, because of the past colonial history of France, the difficult relationship with Algeria, notably, has always been also a magnet, a strong Muslim population. There's always, you know, the Islamic terrorists of the kind of Daesh or ISIS will first try France, and then they'll move to other countries if they can't succeed. You know, remember Spain a few years ago, the bombing in the train. Now it's the turn of Belgium. So they will probably try, you know, peripheral, smaller countries where probably it's easier to defeat the police.
Well, just in closing there, do you think that this will be a wake-up call for the Belgian authorities, given that Brussels itself has 19 communes with 19 separate mayors, six police forces plus the one federal police force? So obviously keeping track of the 560 that have gone off to fight jihad with the Islamic State and returned is a pretty big job. Is that likely to happen? And I guess the second question would be, is there likely to be an uptick in sort of xenophobia and anti-Islamic sentiment amongst the European populations in Belgium, not to mention the fact that here in the United States we have Donald Trump running for president saying he's going to close the door on all Muslims and not allow them into the country. And just today, his rival, who's the second choice for the Republicans for president, Ted Cruz, said we need to empower law enforcement to patrol and secure Muslim neighborhoods before they come radicalized here in the United States. Not that there are Muslim neighborhoods to begin with, but there's an awful lot of xenophobic and Islamophobic rhetoric over here. Do you expect an uptick in it there in Belgium?
Well, to your first question, I think it's quite clear that it's really, for Belgium today, it's an extremely difficult, that those attacks have put Belgium in a very difficult place. They're, of course, mourning and crying for their dead people today, but, of course, as of tomorrow, I think the debate will move on and will become very political. I think, first of all, probably the most pressing issues will be to coordinate and reorganize police forces. I think this will certainly happen. Brussels and Belgium can't afford to let further attacks happen on their soil because, as you were saying in your introduction, it's a small country, it's a capital. But as I overheard on TV, a Belgian person saying, well, we would be otherwise fairly ignored as a small country in Europe, but we are the capital of Europe. You know, all the major EU institutions are based in there. So, of course, they can't afford for safety reasons. Brussels is a fairly small town, but very cosmopolitan. Several religions live coexist peacefully. It's a truly cosmopolitan international city, so I think there will be certainly more coordination and improvement, certainly. So xenophobia, racism and Islamophobia are realities. They exist. It's rising. I think Islamophobia is a reality in France. It's really serious, but not to the point that any major politician, including on the right or far right, would come out saying, you know, we need to ban Muslims, we need to patrol the areas where they live, we need to be suspicious of all of them. It's just down to a few individuals, which probably will have their heads turned by some demagogues, for sure, who will commit individually acts against Muslims. But at the moment, as we speak, we still keep that level of unity and harmony in Europe between different communities.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Philippe Mallier.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Philippe Mallier, who's a professor in French and European politics at the University College in London, who in 2007 was awarded the Marcel Liebman Chair in Political Science by the Université Libre de Bruxelles, the Free University of Brussels. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Republican presidential candidates Donald Trump and Ted Cruz are exploiting the terrorist attacks in Belgium. We are Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lawrence Korb, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center of Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Korb.
Nice to be with you again.
And what do you make of, in the wake of these hideous bombings in Belgium, this time the xenophobia and Islamophobia is coming not from Donald Trump, although I'm sure he will pile on, but his rival, Ted Cruz, who was, as far as I can tell, the Republican establishment's alternative choice to the train wreck they expect Donald Trump to be in terms of the down ballot for Republican senators and congressmen in the 2016 elections. Today, Ted Cruz comes out and says, we need to empower law enforcement to patrol and secure Muslim neighborhoods here in the United States before they become radicalized. What is he talking about? What Muslim neighborhoods do you know of, Larry?
Well, there are none. Paradoxically, there was a Muslim neighborhood in Brussels. So that is what happens when you don't assimilate different groups into society like we do. We don't have Muslim neighborhoods. And so basically, the lesson should be the last thing you want to do is create Muslim neighborhoods or put them on the defensive by, you know, doing things like going around checking the houses of people who happen to be Muslims.
So do you expect this to have any traction in this election season? I mean, if there was an attack in this country, a lot of analysts say that that would probably secure Donald Trump's presidency.
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that it will play well in the election. As you saw after San Bernardino, people were saying, see, we got to be tougher against ISIS in the Middle East. We got to cut down, immigrants coming into this country from the Muslim world. So in the short term, it will. But in the long term, it's a self-defeating, type of approach that will make the situation even worse and make it more dangerous because it'll feed into the narrative of these people who want to do us harm.
So in terms of what happened yesterday, where Donald Trump went to the editorial board meeting at the Washington Post and outlined or sketched his foreign policy team for the first time, and then later spoke before AIPAC, from what I understand, this list of five people that he's named, General Keith Kellogg, Carter Page, George Papadopoulos, Waleed Faris, and Joseph Schmitz, has been met with scorn, derision. It's not as if it's the A team, it's like the D team. How would you rate these people?
Well, I think each of them are basically, lean in the wrong direction if you want a good national security, policy. And no, none of them have the experience. Like one of the people, Schmitz, was the inspector general in the Pentagon, but they pushed him out for, acting inappropriately. So I think that's really, that we have to take a look at. There's no doubt about the fact that Trump's been pushed on this, so he did mention a few, but this is not the group that you want running the country. I mean, you got people from Blackwater. Remember the problems that they caused when they were in Iraq.
Well, but Trump is the one that's been saying on the stump that we're going to make weapons that the soldiers and sailors need, not that the contractors and lobbyists foist on us. And my understanding is that General Joseph Smith, when he was Inspector General at the Pentagon, got into trouble because of his lavish spending and having expensive bathroom fixtures, etc.
Well, he'd be the wrong person that you want to be getting advice for if you want to get the most cost-effective weapons, for the troops. And again, I think it just shows like he doesn't care. I mean, I'm sure there are better people he could have gotten, but to get an inspector general, who acted inappropriately, particularly when his job is to make sure other people don't act inappropriately.
So in his comments on NATO, saying NATO is costing us a fortune and we're protecting Europe with NATO, but we're spending a lot of money and the Europeans aren't stepping up. And the next day, there's an attack at the capital of the European Union, and its fingerprints go back to ISIS, Daesh, the Islamic State, in Syria and in Iraq. 560 Belgians have gone off to fight for Daesh and returned. So that it's obviously a hotbed, but how can you sort of abandon NATO and abandon, you know, at the same time say you're going to take care of the Islamic State and wipe them out? Or, and in Ted Cruz's case, he keeps floating the same old canard that Barack Obama has failed to confront or even properly identify radical Islamic terrorists. So that's their mantra. What effect do you think the terrorist attack in Belgium is likely to have? Will it buttress the Islamophobes and xenophobes on this side, or will it undercut them?
Well, I think it's going to, at least in the short term, amplify the Islamophobia, because I think what you're going to see in Europe is much less willingness to take in the refugees from the, you know, from the Middle East, which would be a disaster. You'll see them try and close their borders. You know, if you go to Europe now, once you get in, you can go any place without, you know, getting checked at the border. And in the short term may alleviate people's concerns, but in the long term, it'll be disastrous for Europe to do that. And I think you're seeing basically Trump and Cruz saying the same thing about the United States. We have to be careful about who we take in here, and you know, not take in any more, you know, the quote unquote those people. And it'll feed into the ISIS narrative. See, they'll say, see what the West thinks about us. That's why we got to attack them.
Again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Korb, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. So, but again, already the Europeans have in fact closed the door on a further flow from Syria into Greece in an agreement with Turkey. But, you know, the theory is that amongst the million or so refugees who flooded into Europe in the last year and a half, the Islamic State sort of sprinkled a few people in there. And I guess that would apply here, but I don't think we've let in very many people from Syria, and the Canadians have let in considerably more than we have. So is that likely to be sort of amplified as a threat to the United States?
Oh, no doubt about it. As I say, remember after San Bernardino, with, you know, the reaction was. So I'm sure there will be, but again, hopefully, given a president like Obama, he can make cooler heads prevail. And you're right, we've only taken in about, you know, are projected to take in 10,000. But you know, if you go back and you take a look at all of the immigrants and refugees we've taken in the last 30 years, we have not had a single instance of any of them, you know, causing problems. The real threat you have basically is now people become self-radicalized. They believe the propaganda put out by ISIS, fueled by some of the statements, unfortunately, made by some of our political figures, and they take matters into their own hands. And, you know, if you take a look at what happened in Belgium, you have a lot of people from Belgium who went to fight in Iraq and Syria against what they saw as the West trying to undermine Islam, and they came back, they got radicalized and came back, and look what they did both in Paris and now in Brussels.
So is there then in this new environment a national security strategy that, for example, Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders could enunciate to neutralize this expected exploitation of what happened in Belgium?
Well, I think the strategy should be, look, we've got one of the problems that you have in Europe is they don't share intelligence to the extent that they ought to. So that's important that we share intelligence so we can stop these attacks. In fact, if you go and look, all the attacks we stop even before they started, well, no, that doesn't become big news. So we need to share intelligence. We need to have the Belgian police are not very good at all in, you know, dealing with, you know, security threats. Our, I think our police force and our Department of Homeland Security security are very good, and then make sure that we adequately fund Homeland Security. Everybody says, well, let's, you know, carpet bomb them. No, the real protection has got to be the Department of Homeland Security here in the United States to stop these plots before they get going.
So there's no way to, you can't have a leak-proof defense. And the expectation is that this is going to continue, that people are going to be infiltrated into Europe and into the United States if they can. It's obviously much more difficult to get into the United States. At what point is there a strategy to stop it altogether? Because to my mind, there really isn't a military solution to this problem. The solution, to my mind, lies in Saudi Arabia, to get the Saudi Arabians to start taking responsibility for Wahhabism, which is their brand of Islam that they have, through their petrodollars, they've spread around the world. And they've had an enormous effect, I think, in radicalizing Islamists.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. Remember that 19 of the 21 people who hit the World Trade Center were Saudis? And, you know, President Obama, to his credit, if you read the interview he gave to Jeff Goldberg in The Atlantic, he calls out the Saudis. And, you know, basically, yeah, we've got to, you know, we got to do that. Senator Sanders, in the speech he gave yesterday, which AIPAC wouldn't let him do via satellite, so he gave it in Utah, you know, he also, you know, talked about, you know, the fact that we've got to tell the Saudis, you know, you got to cooperate with us in fighting ISIS. And, you know, because in the final analysis, you're more in danger than we are, you know, given where, you know, where you are. And we will not defeat ISIS unless we undermine their ideology. I mean, militarily, we can contain them and kind of push them back. But at some point, we've got to undermine their ideology. And that can only be done by, you know, leading, Arab and Muslim countries.
Well, you mentioned the AIPAC speech that Bernie Sanders offered to deliver remarks by video, as Netanyahu and others have done, and the organizers of the AIPAC conference did not agree to that. Donald Trump, of course, had a speech. He was loudly cheered, particularly when he said he was going to move the embassy to Jerusalem, the eternal capital, which got a big round of applause. But in general, it does seem that there's always been this disconnect. Jewish Americans, by, I think, a factor of, what, 75% vote Democrat and vote for Obama?
Yeah, yeah.
And yet AIPAC has a powerful influence. Do you think that AIPAC could essentially just become a representative of the right wing, since it's so close to Netanyahu to begin with and Adelson and company? And would that sort of basically clarify matters? If they were just, you know, if liberal American Jews did not give them support and, say, for example, supported J Street.
Well, there's no doubt about it. If you look at the opinion polls, young Jewish Americans are not, you know, supportive of the Netanyahu governing philosophy and, you know, national security strategy. There's no doubt about that. So if AIPAC doesn't change, or, you know, they keep going down the kind of the Netanyahu path, I think they're going to find out that other groups like J Street are going to be seen as more, you know, more relevant to what's going on. And, you know, it's interesting, if you read all of the speeches that were given yesterday, including Senator Sanders, which he gave in Utah, you know, he's the one that really called out the Netanyahu government on a lot of things that they're doing. And of course, as he started his speech, I don't know if you saw it or read it, where he said, you know, I'm the only presidential candidate who's lived in a kibbutz, but let me tell you. And then, you know, he went on and said, yeah, the Palestinians have done things they shouldn't, but so has the Netanyahu government, not given the Palestinians their, you know, money that they're collecting in taxes, and not you know, and continuing the settlements that you know, undermine the negotiations.
Well, Lawrence Corbe, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks for having me. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Corbe, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center of Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether Donald Trump is getting more people out to vote for him or motivating more people to vote against him. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael McDonald, a professor of political science at the University of Florida and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He is the principal investigator on the Public Mapping Project, a project to encourage public participation in redistricting, and is also the director of the United States Election Project. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael McDonald.
Oh, great to be with you.
And I'd like to look into this so-called enthusiasm gap that's been talked about a lot in this primary election season, the notion being that record numbers of Republicans are showing up to vote, but there's not a lot of enthusiasm on the Democratic side, and that bodes ill for whether it's Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton in the general election. Let's begin with the Republican side. Are the Republicans doing better, and is Donald Trump correct when he claims that he's bringing out all kinds of independents and previously disengaged citizens into the GOP?
Yeah, well, let me take a high level and come back and answer your question, because I think the high level is very important because it tells us the dynamics that are happening in the campaigns that are going to be pulling people to the polls. And among many reasons why people participate in an election, two of them are very relevant for this election cycle. One is that you have a very competitive election, and the other is that there's actually an interesting choice among the candidates. And so if you look at the Democratic side right now, what we observe is that, well, Bernie Sanders has basically conceded much of the South to Hillary Clinton, and so the levels of competition are very low. You can see it in the pre-election polls. You can see it in the actual election results in the states. And so if you're a Democrat and you're thinking, well, am I going to show up to vote? And you think, well, I already know who's going to win. Clinton's going to win in my state. So you decide not to vote. Or maybe you have an open primary state, and then you look over at the Republican side because you have a choice now, and you could say, oh, well, there's something interesting happening over here on the Republican side. There are multiple candidates running, and it's actually meaningful if a lower a third or fourth place, because you can still win delegates. So there's more competition over there. The other thing that's also interesting that's happening here is that the candidates are themselves interesting to the voters in different ways. On the Democratic side, if you look at the exit polls, the Democrats, 70% plus of them will tell you they're satisfied with their candidates going into the general election. Now, of course, you've got some Sanders and Clinton supporters who say, no, you know, this is very, I really like my candidate. Put those people aside. Most Democrats are very satisfied with their candidates. If you look on the Republican side, we see that there's stark difference there. Each candidate, it's like 50% or less of the Republican voters are telling you that they would be satisfied with that particular candidate going into the general election. So there's real choice. There's meaningful choice on the Republican side. In fact, it's almost talked about in doomsday terms, in terms of Trump, that he will be the doom of the Republican Party if he's the Republican nomination. And there's this Never Trump movement there to try and stop him from winning the nomination. So the stakes are very high on the Republican side. So again, if you look at it, competition, interest in the election, there are two very important reasons that we would say that people are being drawn in to vote in the Republican side versus the Democratic side.
And is there a crossover effect in the sense that people on the Democratic side are being drawn in to vote because of Trump? You hear a lot about that, that people on the left in this country are alarmed at what they see as a right-wing candidate who is, you know, has often been described as having fascist-type trappings like Mussolini amongst some, and others suggest that he's more akin to a kind of right-wing populism in the form of what we've seen in earlier races. Right-wing populist in the vein of, say, a George Wallace. So is that a factor?
It can be. So let's just imagine that right now there's all this interest and excitement on the Republican side, and I do believe it's very true that Trump is pulling in some people who don't normally participate in Republican primaries. We can actually see this in terms of his comment, you know, I love the poorly educated people. And we might laugh at that, but there's a nugget of real important truth behind that, which is that lower educated people don't normally participate in Republican primaries. And we are seeing them voting, and we're seeing them participate and supporting Trump in the exit polls. We can also see some evidence in some of the voting data we have from election officials and the voter registration files, We can also see evidence of people who don't normally participate in Republican primaries showing up to vote. So he's pulling some people in, that's without a doubt. And I also believe it's very true that he's pulling in some people to vote against him as well. You're getting the crossover vote of Democrats and independents who, like in Ohio, were supporting Kasich against Trump. So there's that dynamic that's going on. When we get to the general election, those people who are voting against Trump at the moment, they are also going to continue voting against Trump when we get to the general election. And, you know, some of the Republicans who are currently supporting another candidate will come home and support him. But we already have some public officials saying that they would never support him in a general election. So that's that dynamic of polarization that's so present right now just within the Republican primary electorate. When we get to the general election, when turnout's going to be twice what it is right now, we're going to see Democrats are being pulled in. And that could be very meaningful. There could be some Democratic groups that have traditionally low turnout rates that are going to show up in ways that they haven't shown up before. I'm really thinking about Latinos, because Latinos, depending on the election, their turnout rates are about 10 to 15 percentage points lower than the whites and the blacks. And so if they are activated by a potential Trump presidency, then that could be very meaningful for the Democrats in terms of you know, a very meaningful increase in turnout rates among a core Democratic constituency. That could put some states like Arizona into play. It could move states like Nevada and New Mexico completely off battleground status. It could move Colorado away from battleground status. It could even move a state like Florida and more leaning in a Democratic direction. And so the pathway for the presidency for Trump would have to be really these disaffected whites who are showing up, these poorly educated whites that he loves so much. And that would be putting places like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin in play. Because if you can't, as a Republican candidate, win Florida, you've got to do this clean sweep of the the Northeast, the sort of central Midwest there, in order to win the Electoral College.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael McDonald, a professor of political science at the University of Florida and the director of the United States Election Project. But statistics, and I believe these are ones that you put together, Michael, say that the Republican primaries, compared to the one 4 years ago, this year they're up by 7.5 million votes, or about 60%. And so the question would be then, does the increased turnout in a Republican primary, is that the same thing as bringing in new people, which is what Donald Trump is claiming?
Well, he is bringing in new people. But again, I go back to this this notion that the election results now, or the turnout now, projects to the general election. There are these very special dynamics that are going on right now within the primary of people both being drawn in to support Trump, but also people being drawn in to oppose him. And when we get to the general election, we're going to see that dynamic magnified over multiple times, because we're going to be in a general election, and the policy differences that are being put forward by a Trump presidential candidate are going to be much different than either Clinton or Sanders. And so the lines are going to be very stark for the voters. And they're going to see, a very interesting election. And I believe that the turnout is going to be much higher. And you're going to see people right now who are staying at home, by and large, because they don't really care who the Republican nominee is. They're going to care when they get to the general election as to the choices that are being put before them.
So the fact that 2008 was such a record turnout for the Democrats with Barack Obama, and I'm sure it had a lot to do with the crash in Wall Street. So that's a high bar, right? You're suggesting that either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders are going to have a hard time getting up to the 2008 turnout?
Yeah, and look, we've actually had three states so far where Democrats succeeded where they were in 2008. The highest turnout states so far are Democratic states, places like Vermont, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, but it also goes first, so it's another reason why it has high turnout. The signs are actually mixed when you start looking down into the data. And I want to look, point out one particular state that's of sort of is the breaks the rule. It's the exception that it shows that how that this is not a good comparison. If we look at just the turnout differential between the Democrats and Republicans, and we're going to use that to predict what's going to happen in the general election, you have to explain to me why in North Carolina, out of 2.3 million votes or so far that have been recorded, the differential between the Democrats and Republicans is less than 10,000 votes. And when all is said and done, when all the provisionals are counted, it may be that the Democrats actually exceed the Republican turnout. That happened in Louisiana, by the way, too. More Democrats, more people participated in the Democratic primary than the Republican primary. So what's going on there is that, well, you know, in North Carolina particularly, there were other elections on the ballot. There were reasons to keep Democrats home and keep them interested to vote in their elections because they had state primaries on the ballot. So they are energized. Democrats are there. They're participating. It's just that in these states where there's a choice of which party's primary you're going to participate in, Democrats are looking at the Democratic side and saying, oh, the presidential election's not terribly interesting to me, but there's really interest that's going on the Republican side. It doesn't mean that they're going to vote Republican when we get to the general election.
Well, so the enthusiasm factor on the Republican side is hard to define, I take it. I mean, in 2012, there was a great deal of enthusiasm, I understand, on the Republican side in terms of statistics and anecdotal information, even though Donald Trump, of course, trashes Mitt Romney. I mean, Romney thought he had won, but he did lose. So enthusiasm doesn't mean you're going to win, right?
It's one indicator. And, you know, right now I'm beating down the story that this high turn on the Republican side actually means that it's predetermined that the Republicans are going to win in the general election. But there are, you know, I would say that there are some important things that are happening here that could be meaningful to the Republicans. One is that you've got a number of people who, especially these people who haven't participated in previous primary elections and who actually don't participate in elections generally, they're showing up to vote and they're putting down a record that they were interested in the Republican primary. Now, not all of them are going to be people who are going to support the Republicans in the general election, but some of them are. And this is an opportunity for the Republican voter mobilization organization to go out and contact those people come November or October, really, and encourage them to support the Republican nominee. Right now, the Democrats have been doing this sort of data infrastructure going back to the 2008 election. They've got a big head start on the Republicans. Any information that the voters can provide themselves to the Republican Party that they may be interested in their candidates, that's a boon to the Republican Party because they need to get up to speed. They showed some signs of being able to do this in the 2014 election, they being the Republicans. I think that they'll be able to carry that the first inklings of being able to catch up with the Democrats that we saw in 2014. I think they'll be able to carry that through to 2016. And, you know, so there is some good news here for the Republicans. I wouldn't say that it's inconsequential. I just don't think that in and of itself, the greater level of turnout in the Republican nominating contest so far means definitively that the Republicans are going to win in the general election.
Well, one of the phenomena in this election that's pretty unusual and it seems to be getting somewhat out of hand is that these primaries and these rallies have become a contact sport between Donald Trump supporters scuffling with young protesters, many of whom are reacting, and they come from minority communities, reacting to the insults that Donald Trump has leveled at them and their communities. And I suspect this is a growing phenomenon. I think that there'll be more and more student protests. They may well dog Donald Trump all the way till November. And there's mixed reviews on whether this brings out more support for Donald Trump or, on the other hand, whether these optics over the long term, the voters will find them very unsettling and that Trump will be sort of seen as the candidate of chaos. What's your prediction on that?
Well, I have tongue-in-cheek already called the 2016 general election the hate election. And tongue in cheek, but the truth there is that voters don't particularly like Donald Trump, and they don't. I think most likely it's going to be Clinton as the nominee of the Democratic Party. They don't particularly like Clinton either. Now they don't like Clinton a little less than Donald Trump, but the Republicans have been priming outrage against Clinton for decades now. So it's not, this is not something that we are unfamiliar with here. And we're so what's going to motivate a lot of people to vote in this general election isn't so much voting, you know, particularly for a candidate, although, of course, there are going to be a lot of people who are going to do that. A lot of what's going to be happening here is what's going to motivate people are voting against the other candidate. Will young people stay at home? Because right now, if Clinton's a nominee, you would say, well, they're supporting Sanders, and they're not going to show up to vote with such enthusiasm to vote for Clinton. That may not be their motivation. Their motivation, as you're mentioning, is voting against Trump and protesting against him. And so, yeah, this could be a very high turnout election. I think it's possible just to see these sorts of protests happening. You know, we have to go back to the 1960s, again, to Wallace and others, to see this sort of energy in a Republican primary or a Democratic primary, for that matter. So there could be a lot of energy here in this election, and that could really translate to high turnout rates. And if we top the 1960s turnout rates, which were in the low to mid-1960s, we could have the highest turnout rate election that we've seen really since the machine era of politics, going all the way back more than a century of American politics.
Well, just in closing, Mike McDonald, what happens if Ted Cruz is the nominee? Do you think that will take away a lot of the enthusiasm on the Democratic side?
Hard to know. Because right now people aren't focused on Ted Cruz as a choice between for the general election. Trump is the leading candidate. So we really have to monitor what happens. You know, there are a lot of unknowns that can happen. I mean, if anything, the attacks in Belgium today remind us that there are uncertainties that could happen at any point in time. And so there's a lot of play left in this election. There's no one definitive sign that says that something's preordained. And we'll just have to continue to watch what happens when, you know, someone like a Cruz would be is still very punitive in terms of immigration, and that might still rile up people who are care passionately about that issue, as an example. So it's hard to know right now. It's just that I think largely the choice within the Republican Party is either Trump or not Trump. It's not what happens if Cruz is the nominee.
Sure. Well, Michael McDonald, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael McDonald, who's a professor of political science at the University of Florida and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's a principal investigator on the Public Mapping Project, a project to encourage public participation in redistricting, and is also the director of the United States Election Project. And since the polls in today's primaries will be closing later tonight after this program is off the air, we'll be covering the results tomorrow. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.